This is Spectrum.
Alternative medicine. Homeopathy. Secret society. Hypnosis. The paranormal. Alternative energy. UFO. Abduction. The weird. The wild. And the wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanis and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. I'm Scott Jordan here, my co-host, Tom Theophanis, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, how's everything going this week, Tom?
Things are going good.
Going good.
Except for the crazy weather we've been having, but other than that, we're okay.
It's cold, it's hot, it's cold, it's hot. It's up and
it's
down
snowing.
The dog sign lane. Yeah, I know, craziness. Who do we got this week?
Well, tonight we have Dr. Nick Begich, which is the eldest son of the late United States Congressman from Alaska, Nick Begich Singer. And also the political activist, Peggy Begich. He's a well-known in Alaska for his own political activities, and he has twice been elected to president of both the Alaska Federation of Teachers and the Anchorage Council of Education. He has been pursuing independent research in the science and politics for most of his adult life. He co-authored with Gene Manning the book Angels Don't Play the Harp, Advances in TELSA Technologies. Welcome, Nick.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be with you folks tonight.
Welcome, Nick. I'm glad to have you. Well, maybe what we can do is, first off, we can go into a little bit of a bullet point history about how you originally got into the area of investigating HARP. I know there's a bit of a story there.
Right. Well, this has been ongoing for, you know, for quite a while. And when we first got involved in it, I was actually working for the Anchorage School District at the time, and I had read an article on this project here in Alaska, which just really struck me because it was, the article was pretty unbelievable, and from my perspective, it was in a foreign magazine, and my nature is to check things out, and it just struck me. So I spent a little bit of time at our library here in Anchorage. We had a really good resource library. And as a consequence, you know, the issues that were identified in that article, I actually verified. I went a little bit further and found quite a bit more information on this system here in Alaska called HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. And as a consequence, I sent the material I'd collected over to a friend of mine who was a physicist, who initially reacted with, "Nah, this can never work," and then came back about a week later and said, "You know, it's elegantly simple, and it will work, and you need to write something." And I'd never really written anything for, you know, science or technology issues. I'd followed him for years. I've been involved in that as in my own personal interest for many, many years. But I went ahead and wrote the article. It was published in the same magazine where I'd read the first one, and as a consequence
Nexus,
of that,
wasn't it?
It was Nexus Magazine, yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And then I ran into Gene Manning, who had been researching the same issue. We met sometime later in Seattle for a brief meeting there and agreed to collaborate, not on another article, but on a book. And that's really how it was born. And then from there, we were able to go from the 20 articles that I had found and the few dozen that she had found to over 300 source documents we ended up using in the text. And, you know, what we wrote back in 1995 over all of these years has proven to be accurate. Correct, and unfortunately correct, because I think the technology is headed a direction that presents some significant risk.
Yeah, definitely. Now, it was Ben Eastland's original, his patent, wasn't it?
Right. He actually had a series of patents. One of them he had actually co-patented with a guy named Ramos, and Ramos was one of the founders of TRW and one of the initiators of the initial Star Wars efforts under the Reagan administration. And what they had envisioned was a number of applications for HARP, but the one that Ramos got particularly excited about was a intercontinental ballistic missile defense shield that you could literally erect around the Earth in such a way that any object with sophisticated electronics coming through this particular region would malfunction and crash. And the idea was to create a system that could guard the United States, particularly, obviously, from nuclear attack. And then from there, Ben Eastland, who was brilliant, a brilliant plasma physicist, and he and I became pretty good friends over the years. Interestingly enough, you know, first it was the controversy, but we never attacked Ben, and we always believed, and it turned out to be rightly so, that, you know, everyone gets involved in projects because they're enthusiastic about what they do know, not because of the problems that they don't know. So we were right on that, and as we got to know Ben, what he started doing is, in all of his professional work, is really publishing a little side note to readers that said essentially, look, you may run into controversy, but don't always take it as negative. You know, take a look at it, hear those issues out, because they may make that for better science. And it did for him. And as a result, some of the things that he was developing, he would not give to the military because he didn't think they would be constructive with him.
What are his feelings on the military applications of HARP?
Well, there's a number. You know, and we had Dr. Eastland with a number of other scientists in a closed conference as our guest when I was executive director of Lay Institute. And so he laid out sort of the pros and cons of HARP and a number of other things that he was researching. But in this particular instance, you know, the idea of military applications aren't all bad. I mean, the reality is, in the world today, the United States needs a strong military. We don't always like the way it's applied around the world, but the fact is we need a strong one. And so developing defense initiatives is particularly a problem. It's just when those defense applications tend to present greater risk to the general population, then we have a problem. And in the case of HARP, there are some risks that are substantial enough to pull back a bit from this system and re-examine whether it should move forward at all.
Okay.
Nick, I was wondering, can you explain what HARP does and is?
Yeah, HARP is a radio a set of radio transmitters. It's actually a field of antennas. There's 180 of them in the grid right now. Each of them is approximately 72 feet tall and has a crossed dipole going the opposite direction, parallel to the ground, that's 60 by 60 feet. So imagine 180 of these together in a field. And what happens is energy is produced, electrical energy, and then converted to radio frequency energy and pushed through those antennas in a very specific way that causes the energy, the radio frequency energy, to be focused or concentrated to a relatively small area. If you think about that in the same way you think about a laser focusing light, if you take a flashlight, for instance, and you shine it up against the wall, it's obvious the beam gets wider and wider as you leave the flashlight. Well, the same principle applies to radio frequency energy. It spreads out as you get further and further away from the signal generator. That's why radio signals on radio stations become weaker and weaker with distance, or less dense, less concentrated. Now, if you can focus the energy like you can with a laser, then you could create much different effects. I mean, think of the difference between light and lasers and the difference between a radio frequency signal in the normal sense and a focused radio frequency signal. They behave totally differently. In the case of HARP, they're targeting two general areas. One is the ionosphere itself, which is an electromagnetically charged area above the Earth's surface. It begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface and extends for several hundred miles out, and it acts like a big cosmic filter. It keeps out various particle streams and energy streams from entering the Earth that would make life impossible here. So it's a very vital part of the Earth, but it's also responsible for the character and quality of communications across the planet. When we have solar flares and solar activities, the ionosphere gets disturbed, and that disturbance then affects all terrestrial communications, and on really extreme situations can affect power grids. The other area target is are the magnetic field lines that naturally surround the Earth. And these field lines start at the South Pole, extend out to the North Pole. And what they can do with the HARP system is actually send an energy form in the form of a cyclotron resonance. The radio frequency goes in. And if you could visualize that energy then just sort of corkscrewing around or like a snake coiling around that magnetic field line, but instead of going the energy going from south to north, this coiled energy is now going north to south, and there are accelerated electrons that then flow down to the Antarctic, And what happens then is it creates an energy field, that any object coming in and out of that energy field will be disrupted and crash, satellites, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and so on. So two different areas you're affecting, and then for a whole series of various effects, depending on how you manipulate that energy, are possible with HAARP. And originally it was Air Force and Navy. Today it's controlled by DARPA, which primarily does defense research for the various branches, the military as well as the intelligence community.
Okay, that's good. So it can basically create a blanket area and take out everything. Now, can it be more precise and take out, say there's 100,000 missiles coming over, can it pinpoint like the 100 or so that actually have nuclear weapons and the others are dummies? Can
well,
it pinpoint those?
This is a great question, and actually it can. There's a way to do that. In fact, it showed up in the patents, and there's sort of three sort of phases to this. The first is the over-the-horizon radar, which is the idea of locating objects that are, you know, over the horizon. In the old technologies, you would not be able to see things as they get closer and closer in and lower to the ground. With the HAARP applied technology, you get everything from intercontinental ballistic missiles all the way down to cruise missiles, and you get them at close range and far out. But you need two transmitters to achieve it, and one transmitter acts as a ionosphere heater, creating a plasma, a wall of energy, almost like a mirror of energy in the upper atmosphere, lower ionosphere. And then that second transmitter then focuses energy and bounces it off of that reflector to the over the horizon and down to the Earth, where you get your imaging capability. Then if you crank the energy up a little bit more, and then using gamma ray detectors on space-based satellites, it'll create an energy signature around every one of those objects. And in that energy signature, you can pick out which ones are the real threats carrying nuclear payloads and which ones are just decoys. And in these scenarios, over 100,000 incoming objects would be headed our way, of which perhaps only a few dozen would be serious threats. The others would be conventional warheads. And then the last step in this, first detection, second the discrimination or sorting them out, and then the third is, with enough power, you could create an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, a surge of energy sufficient enough to disrupt all of the electronics on all of the objects coming in and drop them all out of the sky. And that would include any commercial aircraft, satellites, or anything else that happened to be collateral damage in the way of that energy burst.
Now, it's like, if you put enough power in it, you could melt the circuits.
Well, you could. Theoretically, that's true. But technically, you probably don't need that much power. You could do it with just enough power to disrupt the electron flow through those microcircuits, which then disrupt all the navigation systems and, again, bring the crafts down.
Now, does this signal goes, we're talking like inside the Earth's atmosphere, or is it above the Earth's atmosphere?
Well, everything originates above in the ionosphere, and essentially what you're using HAARP for is to trigger reactions within the natural environment, as well as the directed energy of the system itself. But when you think about HAARP, think about it in this way. In one application, they sent energy up into the ionosphere, and they discovered a really unique window frequency. And a window frequency is where something happens, something reacts. And in this case, the energy amplified 1,000 times. Well, that was pretty startling, and no one expected that. And what it meant is that there was a way to tap energy, to pull energy out of the ionosphere, and that became pretty exciting for a lot of the researchers. But at the same time, helped us recognize that this instrument on the ground acts like a primer on a bullet. It has a very small amount of energy in comparison to the natural energy of the Earth's systems. But this system on the ground literally plugs in to the geophysics of the planet and then can be used to manipulate a number of factors within that geophysics to cause some significant changes and releases of otherwise, you know, natural energy, which is vastly greater than anything man could create. But learning how to trigger that or tune into that to cause specific effects, that's where the higher risks associated with HAARP come in.
Okay. But
if the let's say a bunch of missiles are coming from another place, and it takes out the electronics and the missile, they've been disabled and that's all, like, in that way, or would it explode it?
No, it wouldn't explode it.
Well, it would depend. I mean, it depends on what circuits, I suppose, it disrupted. But if it can't navigate, it's going to go down. You know, and that's the objective, is to get them down out of the sky.
Just to bring them out of the sky.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So what about... now, you can also use HARP for ground topography.
Mm-hmm.
And penetrating into below the surface of the ground... I think it was Brooks Agnew who was doing ground topography work with an instrument, and he was only using 30, was it 30 watts?
Yep, 30 watts.
It was 30 watts, and he was getting down several miles, I think.
Right.
And HARP's a hell of a lot bigger. I mean, what could it, what are the limits of that? I mean,
this is the big issue, because ground penetrating tomography is really an interesting idea, and it's this idea. In fact, it was proven HARP can do this, and it's very accurate and efficient. It can look under the ground several kilometers or miles deep and determine underground ground strata in terms of oil, gas, water, underground facilities, tunnels, caverns, mineral deposits of various kinds, and this imaging with HARP is not 30 watts. It's projected to be an effective radiated power. Now, that's not the power on the ground. That's the power based on a very complicated formula. But the effective radiated power would be a billion watts, a gigawatt,
yeah,
which is tremendous.
Huge.
And the concern that Brooks Agnew had was really two. One is, would this create a shunt or a conductive area between the Earth and the ionosphere, which would then cause that energy in the ionosphere to begin to flow rapidly to the Earth's surface to the point in which that signal was being generated, which would be, in fact, the HARP facility. What would happen in the worst-case scenario, from his perspective, is you would see the largest bolt of lightning you've ever seen in your life hitting the Earth 40 times a second until the energy was totally discharged from the ionosphere, which would then expose the planet to huge risks in terms of cosmic radiation. That was his worst case. The other things that can happen with Earth-penetrating tomography, again, if you hit the wrong window frequency, you can cause, by some people's and very, very well-known people's perspective, we could trigger even an earthquake. And that becomes pretty disconcerting. And the idea that we could trigger an earthquake using electromagnetic energy isn't unique. In fact, it was several years later that Secretary of Defense William Cohen, when he was in that position with Bill Clinton in 1997, he made the following comment, and I quoted this in my book, Earth Rising, the Revolution, and it says, and I quote, "Others are engaging even in eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. That's a pretty powerful statement for a seated Secretary of Defense to attribute to terrorist states, and it's one of the concerns that we have regarding the HARP system.
Yeah, I mean, if they could do that. Now, it was Tesla that did an experiment in sympathetic resonance where he would thump the ground.
Right.
This is maybe the same sort of thing that you could do with HARP. You could dial it in to the sympathetic resonance right over where a fault line is, and you know, the energy is already there. The energy for the earthquake has already been building up.
Right.
If there's a buckle there or a bubble, you could pop that, and, you know, just with sympathetic resonance, could you not?
Well, here's the idea. You know, fault lines, they build up pressure because of the movements in the earth, and it builds up stresses, and then every once in a while they snap. And often associated with those earthquakes is precursors are ELF, extremely low frequency signals, same thing that are generated from, you know, for Earth penetrating tomography. And the idea is, and this goes back to some of the ideas of J.F. Gordon McDonald at UCLA when he was science advisor to President Johnson, this whole idea of geophysical warfare was being talked about quite a bit, and there were a lot of ideas about it. But the idea would be normally and naturally, I mean, excluding these catastrophic events like we've recently seen in Japan, normally these things happen in small bumps. You know, here where I live, we get earthquakes all the time. And and usually they're not extreme. And in fact, when they're not, you know, extreme, we're kind of relieved because you know that the pressures are being relieved and not building up for some huge snap. Now, if
right,
you can
then,
in yeah, it's a good thing actually. And if on the other hand, energy is built up and you can control when that energy is released, and you can cause it to release, you know, in one powerful jolt. Imagine that kind of a weapon system being applied to, say, a country that wasn't necessarily anti-American but wasn't pro-American, wasn't cooperating with us very well, and was maybe in a very strategic place. So, you know, what could we do? Well, maybe we could trigger a natural event that would put a country into a devastating situation where then instead of them being adversarial or not friendly, all of a sudden they're inviting us in to help them out.
Right.
Think about it. There was
relief
actually
efforts,
a treaty,
yeah.
And there was a treaty back in 1977 where we agreed not to use environmental weapons like this as a weapon of as weapons of war. Geophysical manipulation by treaty is off limits, but Rumsfeld during the Bush administration wanted that treaty abandoned because the technologies for environmental manipulation had improved so much that the idea of waging a covert war was just too attractive. I mean, he was thinking in terms of creating droughts and rainstorms and hurricanes, things that would really bring a country to its knees as powerfully as a modern military, but without the footprint of anybody except nature. And that was his objective, was covert warfare, degrade your enemies and adversaries, maybe even your allies when it suits your interests, because that's the kind of government we had, I think, under Bush, was one that you could not trust.
That's a couple of steps beyond a blockade, isn't it?
It's the most powerful blockade of all. You use nature itself against man, and no one's to blame but nature itself.
Yeah, and they could, you know, you could do that and say what you know it was a well you know it was an earthquake. It wasn't us. Had nothing to do with us. You know,
right.
Prove it. Prove it. Go ahead.
Exactly. And no one's going to believe it. You know, not for another 20, 30 years. And that's the problem. I mean, it's no different than say. 60, 70 years ago, somebody walked into a room and said, a beam of light hit me, burned a hole right through my chest, and a nice clean hole right through the chest, and everybody would say, you're out of your mind. Today, everybody would say from the third grader to the senior would say, oh, that was a laser.
That was a laser.
Lasers are common knowledge. And the same is true here. One day, people will look back on this period of time and say, man, I can't believe how reckless we were. And I think this generation will see that day.
Okay, so
what sort of impact would it have on the human health?
Well, this is an important issue also, and it goes back to back to J.F. Gordon MacDonald. And he had written in a book back in 1969 that if we could ever electronically stroke the ionosphere, which is what HARP does, in just the right way, which HARP does, we could return a signal to the Earth that would influence the emotions of people over huge geographic areas. And what he was talking about was there's a mechanism. It's called frequency-following response. And I explain it more thoroughly in a book called Controlling the Human Mind, which gets into this issue, you know, in depth. But as it relates to HARP, the idea of FFR, frequency-following response, creates an entrainment effect where the brain literally locks onto this external signal and then begins to follow it or mirror it, particularly in the ELF range where this is effective. So in the ELF range, the human brain begins to mirror this external signal and as a consequence causes a series of chemical reactions within the brain that literally change your emotional state. And the idea of doing this over a huge geographic area is based on the principle that to create an earth-penetrating tomography application or as either a side effect or a deliberate effect, affect people's emotions, you concentrate the energy from HARP, you focus it on the ionosphere, you pulse the energy, like hitting the ionosphere with a hammer. Every time you hit it, it rings. And as a consequence, a signal comes out of the ionosphere itself, so it becomes the broadcast antenna, only it covers thousands of miles. And it sends back to the Earth, because you convert it from DC now to AC. Now it's an alternating current in the ionosphere, stimulating it as a broadcast antenna, broadcasting an ELF wavelength back to the Earth, and essentially that wavelength can be used for depending on the window frequencies, can trigger these frequency following response in humans, earth penetrating tomography applications that we've already covered, or as a side effect even trigger a geophysical event. All of those things are possible within the mix of utilizing HARP. And the range, it's a high frequency transmitter, but within its secondary capabilities, it can cover what's called 16 decades of frequency, which just means everything from ultra low to visible light, which is essentially everything we use for terrestrial communication and a lot more. So big bandwidth can be affected, even though the actual operating frequency is within a very narrow bandwidth.
I see. Now, if the listeners think this sounds like fantasy, they should go check out a scientist called Jose Delgado, who wrote something called The Physics of Mind Control. And I believe he was talking about modulated and pulse frequency frequencies, wasn't he?
Well, he did
experiments on, we started out doing it on monkeys. He did that famous one with the bull where there was the matador there, and the bull went to run at the matador, and he flipped a switch, and it stopped dead in its tracks, you know?
Right.
Now, there was a lot more he did.
In the old days, he used electrodes. That's when he was at Yale University, and he was planting electrodes in brains to see what part of the brains were responsible for what activities. And then by the 80s, he discovered he didn't need any implants, didn't need any electrodes. He just needed to have a modulated signal, radio frequency signal in the right range that would override those portions of the brain that he was trying to affect and create those changes. He wrote another book called Towards a Psycho-Civilized Society, which was based on the idea that this was a great thing and government ought to impose it on people, make everybody happy and content. Well, it's just too big brother for most of us. And looking at the body of research that came out of this, and really that's what led me to the book Controlling the Human Mind, because this, I think, is the most important issue of all the issues that I've covered. It dwarfs the HARP issue, although it's gotten a lot of notoriety over the years. The idea of affecting the human mind itself, both through systems like HARP and then many, many different systems, was the subject of that research. In fact, it was that book that brought Ben Eastland and a number of other scientists together in a closed conference to deal with that specific issue, mind effects. What kinds of things are happening? How important is it? And what can we do about it? And it was a closed conference. It wasn't open to the public. And we'd invited a number of scientists in to have that discussion. And what Ben Eastland told me was he was in good touch with the head of DARPA at the time, Tony Tether. When he had talked to him about this issue and a number of the directors at DARPA on the mind effects issue, what he said to me, and I quote, he said, "Nick, nobody's laughing anymore," unquote. And he said, people take it very seriously, that it went for him, for not even on his radar screen as important, to one of the most important issues on his radar screen, which is why he agreed to attend our conference. And unfortunately, that was in March of 2007, and or 2008, and by December he was dead. He had passed away, which is very unfortunate because he was really about to do some pretty interesting work that I think would have been useful to all of us on this planet.
Oh, okay. So, do we now? This brings up an interesting point because you have a lot of people on the in the alternative media talking about implants and the dangers of getting the microchip and stuff like that. And what you're saying, by the sounds of it, is they don't even need a microchip.
Microchip is passé. That's like behavior. I mean, if you want to affect a specific individual person, then you might need something different. But even that's questionable these days because as we learn more about sort of the unique signature that each person produces. You know, I mean, we produce our own electromagnetic emanation that is as unique as your fingerprint. That becomes a whole nother area where people are looking to see if there's some way, to sort of track people based on that footprint, given the fact that it does change over lifetime, but if you're maintaining your tracking, you'd be able to keep up with those changes. That's pretty interesting stuff. The implant technologies, from my perspective, because they're becoming smaller and smaller and you're getting greater and greater density on a microcircuit, that now on the head of a pin you can store quite a bit of data, and it's getting better as nanotechnologies advance, what I would expect to see is for tracking humans, like tracking inventory, some form of microcircuit will be used. The other place they're going to be used is in the currency itself, because now they're getting cheap enough where then you'll be able to track the flow of every dollar, every printed dollar bill, which pretty much eliminates the black market currencies, because if those dollars aren't accounted for properly for the tax authorities, it makes it very easy to figure out where the money was and where the money wasn't. And I think that's, again, this more directed and controlled society that we're headed for. You know, and many people are speaking about that. We covered those issues in two other books, one called Earth Rising, the Revolution, and Earth Rising 2, which gets into sort of a mix of technologies and the direction in which we're headed. And you know, and from our perspective at earthpulse.com, we've been really focused on educating the public on technologies, serving as a technology reporter, as if you will. And in the four major books we've published, over 1,650 reference sources were used that were culled from over 100,000 documents that we necked down to 20,000 in our archives at that time. So we do a lot of condensing of data and make it very available to people, and then we footnote every single thing so that if there's questions or more information is needed by professionals or lay people, they have a place to go, and the footnotes appear on every page. And some people find that inconvenient, as most publishers do, but I find myself as a reader, I'd like to see, when I see something that I question, I want to see where it came from. And it's nice to be able to look at the bottom of the page and say, ah, that came from, you know, a congressional report or a New York Times article or what have you. And then I can decide whether I want to accept that or whether I want to look it up and see how it was used in context. And that gives me the opportunity to do it. And I think it also gives lay people the tools they need, because so many writers write some pretty outrageous things without backing it up. And,
right.
And I write to create change. I don't write for entertainment, and I don't write for a living. I make my living doing something else. But I can tell you, I write for change. I'm an activist publisher. I'm not the neutered news. What I have is an opinion based on facts, and those facts I present in a way that is compelling for the public, and it's kept us in this work for 16 years, appearing before scientific bodies, political bodies, and every kind of community group, from UFO conferences, you know, to gatherings of political people from around the world. And you know, and I take most invitations, because my view is people who come to conferences are activists. They get engaged in whether it's these issues or other issues. Part of our mission is also to create and to dissipate the environment of fear that is being created, and try and replace some of that with knowledge. And then the real message behind much of our research, what we have discovered in 16 years, the most important thing, because people have asked us all the time, what can we do? What can we do? And most of that is out of fear. What I can say is, in the research done on the human mind by our government, by our intelligence community, what they discovered that was so critical and so important is perhaps the most important thing of all. And they discovered that humans have what they call now anomalous human capabilities. We used to call those extrasensory perceptions. We used to call those gifts of the spirit. We used to call them all kinds of unexplained things. And what they discovered was that every human being had these latent capabilities, that if they ever manifest, the idea of a transparent government would be so in front of us. And every once in a while they do. And here's the thing. In all that research about mind control and those effects as it relates to HAARP or anything else, people always think about the Manchurian candidate or being manipulated or someone, you know, making
stuff
they don't want to do. But the defense against that and the easiest way to make all that happen and the way that you control the populations the most effective way is the simplest way. All you have to do is create an environment of fear and worry and a little underlying anxiety. And I'll tell you what happens. If you look at an EEG, a device that measures brainwave activity, what you'll see when a person is experiencing fear and worry is incoherent brain patterns, not the kind of brain patterns connected to higher intellectual ordered thinking, none of the brain patterns associated to anomalous human capabilities, none of those that carry us to our higher states of consciousness. In other words, it's the simplest thing of all. All you got to do is watch the news every night and worry about your job, worry about your kids. Fear is the adversary and is used to manipulate populace. Think of 9/11 and the Patriot Act and something done in fear where everybody in the Congress lost their mind for a few days. You know, I mean, this is what fear does. If you can dissipate that, you have the opportunity to reach higher states of awareness. That is the key to defense against all of this. And ultimately, it's a transformation in the way we order ourselves. You know, that science conference on mind effects, I had a physicist and PhD in mathematics who also was a nun. And she taught mathematics to doctoral students in biology at Berkeley for a number of years. She's considered one of the world's experts on radiological victims. And what her presentation in our closed conference was the next evolution of man. And that next evolution of man, from her perspective, is when we reach these higher states of awareness and government becomes transparent. We become transparent to one another, and this world will go through the gnashing of teeth in a total change. But that is possible, and many, many. In fact, I was shocked at the number of people in that room that echoed that same sentiment. And in fact, we had the former biophysicist Alexander K. Varenin, who was the director of the biophysics lab for the USSR Academy of Sciences. For the last 10 years, there was a USSR. And I've known Alex a long time. He spent 6 weeks in my home here in Alaska doing some work with me. And he had just his paper that he presented was a paper explaining the underlying physics of mental telepathy, the mathematics of it, how it works, with other physicists in the room observing that and discussing it. And actually, that particular model, the reason he developed that model is when he was 15 years old, he had seen a demonstration in Russia, USSR, about the paranormal. And it just caught his attention, and he dedicated his life to figuring that out. And this guy has an IQ that's off the charts. If you look up Alexander K. Varenin on a Google search, so it'll clean up the spelling for you, you will be amazed at what this man has done. But that is, I think that is the challenge, and that is what the potential is. And quite frankly, the next years of my life are dedicated to that purpose. I mean, we're continuing to educate the public on these areas of technology, but we are in the process of developing specific technologies as well as offering the technologies of others that help us reach our higher potentials. Because to me, that is the answer. We need to dissipate fear. We need to start recognizing what we are as human beings and begin acting in a way that is constructive rather than destructive if this planet is going to change. And people are waiting, you know, for someone to rise to the occasion. And the good news is we're already all here. It's every one of us. There is no formal organization that doesn't already exist. It's called the human race. And we need to engage the world we're in a way that is much different than the way we've engaged in the past, because it's obvious what we have done in the past has not worked. Continuing that pattern on the backdrop of high technology is the greatest risk that this planet has ever seen, and this generation will decide whether this technology serves our interest and builds the character and quality of the human experience, or absolutely enslave us and destroy that experience.
Now, when he gave that talk, there were other scientists in the room in this closed meeting. How was that received? I mean, was there any, the snickering and the
oh, no.
All right, yeah,
there's
buddy.
No disagreement. We're talking about people that have published hundreds of papers in science, people that are the most well-respected, peer-reviewed, some of them in the world. There was no one laughing in the room. In fact, the mathematics work out. The trick is finding a technician that can move the mathematics, you know, into an electronic circuit. And when that's done, believe me, the demonstration will be made. You know, one of the simple circuits that we've got in design and actually have finished our prototypes, we'll be bringing it out later this year, is the one we demonstrated in the European Parliament when we took the HARP issue forward. You know, they invited us over. They flew me in to give testimony and meet the committee. And this was back in 1998, and it was the Committee on Foreign Affairs, Security, and Defense Policy, and it was a subcommittee on security and disarmament. And on the February 5th, 1998 conference, we had a number of experts there, and I was able to demonstrate an infrasound device, a device that transfers sound, like people are hearing my voice, but instead of coming through a normal speaker. It was actually a transducer was put on the skin, and the sound signal actually appears in the head as that proverbial voice in the head. Now, mine required physical contact, and it has a number of applications, which I don't want to get into tonight. It's a topic for another day. But the point is, it demonstrated this infrasound technology that committee members had heard but never had seen demonstrated. And then what I explained to them is that this could also be done remotely. You didn't need any physical contact. And you could, just like people are hearing our voice today, only the only thing difference would be they'd be standing in a crowd, they'd be the only one hearing that voice. Well, it turned out a few years later in 2005, Woody Norris was awarded the MIT Lemelson Prize of $500,000 for developing exactly that system, which he sold then to the military, that would, as a warning, early warning system, you know, to put around bases so that when people got into a certain zone, they'd hear this voice talking to them, and nobody would be there, just them, you know. And that's a pretty startling technology. But when we demonstrated it in the European Parliament, what happened is my testimony, which I was allocated 15 minutes, they ended up giving me an hour and a half by their questions. At the end, the head of Defense News and the top technology reviewer for Santer, who was head of the European Commission at the time, approached me and said it was the most articulate discussion on weapon systems they had ever heard, and they appreciated the fact that I was there and that they weren't going to let it go. And it was a little less than a year later that they passed their resolution regarding HAARP, and it included, it was actually part of the most important security and disarmament resolution the European Parliament has ever passed. And, you know, and that's by their own recollection. And it was their resolution A4-0005/99. That's 305/99. And it was done on January 28, 1999. There were four sections dealing with HAARP that passed by as large a margin as the preamble. We had gotten a coalition of Social Democrats, Conservatives, and Greens to agree on this, which was pretty much the whole of Europe. And at the end, the 27th section dealt with this mind effects issue. And this is what we were able to demonstrate and prove with 3 feet of unclassified documents. And this is what resulted in this one line on Section 27. It says, and I quote, "It calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings," unquote. Now, I don't know how many people have been around political bodies, but I've been involved in politics for 50 years here. My dad was in the U.S. Senate, was in the state legislature. My brother Mark was mayor of Anchorage and now is a United States senator in D.C. representing Alaska. And I know how the systems work. To get a political body to act, you have to be able to prove absolutely that your case to get a collaboration between the parties. Then secondly, you have to have the evidence to support it, because when you start dealing with an issue like manipulating human beings, the last thing a politician wants to do is go home and answer their constituents without having a really strong body of evidence to show that there's reality there. And that's what we were able to do. And that is extremely important. And since that time, the European Parliament has continued to progress on the issue, but it is a really slow progress. In that hearing, NATO had been invited. They refused to appear. A number of people were invited who refused to appear by the chairman. But those that did appear, Rosalie Bertel, I mentioned her earlier. She was the physicist and mathematician. A number of people from organizations, including the International Red Cross. And we had broadened the agenda to not just deal with HAARP, but also to deal with non-lethal weapons, so we could get into these other applications of HAARP.
Okay. Now, I wanted to just quickly, Tom, I wanted to ask him about weather modification using HAARP. Now, when there's a hurricane, it's a cold front meeting a warm front. Now, how would HAARP interact with that, or could it?
Well, we've seen some of that lately with the formation of tornadoes, actually, which more parallels that model, which is where the cold and the warm come together and you get that shearing action, and we've all seen what that's been doing this week. What you can do, and what Eastland believed you could do, is, and he did actually a follow-on study on just this for the European Space Agency, where he actually wrote a paper, it was peer-reviewed, where you would then heat up using HAARP the cold section or the cold front, heated up sufficiently to reduce the energy differential between the two. So when they hit each other, you wouldn't create that shearing effect. And so that was one of his concepts. He later then, FEMA and NASA contracted him to see if he could do it from space-based lasers using satellites, space-based systems. And he showed how you could use the same idea there. And, you know, and when we've had this many tornadoes, you know, I mean, the excuse to spend the money, and it was Bill Clinton that went to the University of Oklahoma and said, one of these days was when those tornadoes whipped through Oklahoma City and everyone was all upset, and Clinton showed up and says, one of these days we're going to figure out how to control tornadoes, and everybody laughed. Well, that was the same place that Ben Eastland just modeled his latest research, and I'm sure Bill Clinton knew about it because it was a DARPA project.
It was 3 months previous.
Right. So here you have it. You know, and now today, you know, obviously the idea of appropriating money for maybe solving that problem, I can see that happening. I mean, when you have this many people devastated, it's again, you know, you get invited.
Well, what about the other end of the spectrum? Can you, I'm sorry I mentioned a hurricane. I meant tornado. I don't know what I was thinking. But what about increasing its strength? What making it larger? What about steering
it? Deliberately. Or you could do it by mistake, just by heating the wrong area. You know, then all of a sudden now you've really created a situation. Now maybe a Category 1 goes to a Category 5, you know, because of what you've done. And again, right. It's not an exact science, so it's more of an experiment. And here's the real big question is, do you want anybody experimenting with this stuff? I mean, isn't it erratic enough right now without us throwing some more into the mix? And that's been my opinion for some time. And Ben Eastland said this about weather modification. He said it does not belong to the military. They are not the right place to do it. He would not share additional research in that area unless it was open to the entire scientific community across all the disciplines. Other countries were involved, and it moved extremely slowly. And even then, he questioned whether it should be pursued beyond just the basic research. And because he knew that in an environment of secrecy, A, it would be misused, and B, potentially the side effects or the mistakes made by compartmentalizing the science would be not recoverable, because you're actually dealing then with the entire Earth's system. And I don't believe, and Ben Eastland didn't believe, that man was mature enough or wise enough or had enough knowledge to engage that research at that level at this particular time in our history.
What about hurricanes? Can HAARP affect a hurricane hypothetically in any way?
Well, you know, many believe it can. And in talking to Ben Eastland about some of that, I think there's a strong possibility. There are other systems that can as well. You know, back when the smoke was blowing out of Indonesia into Malaysia back a number of years ago, there was a huge controversy, big fires and nonsense going on. And it was a major news media event when they announced, hey, a Russian company just offered to create an artificial cyclone and just blow it out of the way.
I remember that.
And they're not the only ones. You know, the Chinese offered to do that during the Olympics, and the Russians, and now other countries. In fact, the U.S. Congress last session had offered up a bill in the House and the Senate to regulate weather modification, both for the private sector and government, because right now it's an unregulated industry. And what people don't realize is you may solve somebody's rainfall problem in one place and create 20 other problems elsewhere. Now, if you were sitting in a country and somebody manipulated the weather for their benefit and drove the rain into their neighborhood and left you in drought, would you consider that an act of war if you knew they did it? I mean,
yeah, that would be bad.
It starts to get really squirrely when you think, well, I'm protecting my own interests, but at the expense of someone else. And ultimately, it's always about that. And this is, again, where the model has to change, where we have to rethink sort of how we look at the world, which means rethinking how we behave individually and how we behave collectively. And ultimately, I think that's where the solution is. You know, people ask me all the time, how can I protect myself? How can I protect myself? That's the only way. We need to change the character and the direction in which we're going. HAARP is a symptom. Not the single problem. It is a symptom of the problem, along with many other symptoms that are invading our privacy, our personal lives, our intellectual lives, our economic lives. I mean, we are being manipulated more and more every day and becoming more and more transparent as individual people, while governments become less transparent and corporations become more powerful and more influential. We have a very upside-down situation right now that if it is not remedied, we're going to see some serious problems beyond what we're already seeing.
Yeah, I just don't think that that man, I mean, I go from good days to bad days, whether I think man's an angel or a devil, but I think it floats somewhere in between. It depends. You've got all these examples in history. You've got great examples of humans doing great things, but you've also got examples of, you know, the people fighting against the power of the of whatever corrupt government is running their country. And in the rebels, they win the fight, and then they go into power, and they become 10 times more corrupt.
It happens.
You know, I mean, it's just, it's almost like, I hate to say it's human nature, but does seem to be. And then you've got the what's going on in Japan right now, multiple meltdowns happening. They you know, they're changing the level from a level 5 to a, okay, well, it's a level 7. Well, we knew that 3 weeks ago that it was a level
right.
7. You know,
right.
I mean, and then they're saying they're evacuating up to 30 miles. They should be evacuating up to 200 miles, you know, because of the particulates in the air. Why is it that that trait, and how do you see that that's gonna alter and change through time?
You mean in terms of the nature of people?
The nature of the selfishness or the it's all about
fundamentally.
Me,
you know, I think those are attributes that humans have. I also know that that every major thing that's ever happened on this planet started with one or two people seeing it slightly differently. And I believe that that's the same kind of thing that will happen again. Only this time I think there's more people activating that are interested in seeing this kind of change. And I think it is possible. You know, I read one of the most interesting books. In fact, out of all the things I've read in my life, and I've read thousands, literally thousands of books, it gets into this thing about fear pretty well. And it's a book called A New Earth by an author named Tolle, T-O-L-L-E. Pretty important book. I consider it one of the two most important books I've ever read, and it gets to the heart of the fear and gets to the heart of what drives it. I think solutions are possible. I think people are waking up. I think the opportunity for change is here as much as the opportunity for total destruction. They always exist in the same instant. It's a question of choice that we each individually make that changes the game, and we need to start making different individual choices to change that game.
Yeah, that was a book by Eckhart Tolle.
Yep.
Wrote a
very
book
important
called
book.
So you think that that's possible, that as if more and more people awaken to these higher senses, or I mean, back in the early days, I don't know if it was early days, but it was a long time ago. The Monroe Institute worked with binaural beats. And that
right.
was working within the mind and using technology as well.
Yeah, great technology. I carry their products on the website, earthpulse.com. Monroe has great stuff. There's a lot of things out there for enhancing human performance, and many devices that are being developed that are developed for improving human performance, reducing stress. You know, and a lot of those technologies, you know, we carry. We've either found them and done the due diligence on them, and then we're also creating our own circuits now that we think will bring even more dimension to this whole discussion of what's possible for enhancing human performance in the 21st century.
Okay.
And Nick, I have a kind of a question here as well. Has HAARP, with all its abilities, ever been used in places like Afghanistan, for instance, when they went looking for the Taliban and
that was part of the whole idea of underground tomography. It was first after the first Gulf conflict. That was the big deal. In fact, going back to the 90s again, it was at the time it was the senior senator from Alaska who my brother replaced, Ted Stevens, and he really thought this was, you know, this was the deal. And so no funding was granted to HAARP until they could prove that that worked. And then on a show called, I believe it was called New Horizons or Horizons. It was a BBC special, and the special segment was Owning the Ionosphere, and it was where the scientists at HAARP acknowledged that they had actually made those tests and had proven with 99% accuracy they could map underground facilities. And then from there on, they continued to get their funding.
So don't you find it hard to believe that they couldn't find these guys up there with all these technologies that we have?
Well, I don't, because of one other thing is that the Taliban are not stupid, and they know the first thing they got rid of was all of their electronics, because all of your electronics create signatures. So they're riding horses, for goodness sake. You know, they're carrying light arms and weapon systems that don't involve high degrees of electronic signature. They dump their cell phones. You know, they get rid of stuff that is traceable, trackable, and monitored, and that can triangulate position. They're smart people. You know, everything that I've read, everything I've discussed is in the open literature. If people don't believe that these guys are sophisticated enough to review that open literature, you're missing it, because that's exactly what's happening.
But I mean, if HARP can be pinpointed and you know, create some sort of mental manipulation, could it not be used for that purpose?
You're going to affect an entire population. You're not going to pin it down to one person. You're going to cover a hemisphere.
Yeah.
And then, but how anxiety.
How much can it be honed down to specific?
It's not useful that way. It's just not useful at all that way. There's other systems that do that. I'd recommend a really excellent article by the U.S. Army War College called The Mind Has No Firewalls. Any electromagnetic carrier can be used to manipulate human behavior. Radio broadcast, TV, internet, telephone, the power grid itself. You can put a signal right on top of the signal that we're broadcasting on right now and carry a signal in that will influence people, and nobody would even know it. Any of these systems can be used, and that's the point. And this is a point everyone misses. Everyone looks at mind control, they think about HARP, only because we haven't let the issue go and we put it out there so far. But there are much more efficient ways to target individuals, groups, or in fact, even in the first Gulf War, after the first Gulf War was over, it was Scottish media that reported that we had used Project Solo, where we had piggybacked a signal on their radio broadcast. They're broadcasting the Muslim music and prayers into the country, and we just piggybacked a signal on top of theirs that created an underlying sense of dis-ease, of anxiety, of stress. And what did we see in the first Gulf War? The fourth largest army in the world give up like they had just been on a first-grade fire drill. You know, it was ridiculous. They were, you know...
Yeah, walking out of the desert with their hands held high, and yeah.
Yeah, and this is exactly... Before the Scottish media reported on, I was asked by CBC TV in Canada about this, and I said, well, I'm speculating now, but the time will come, and this was filmed and broadcast. I said, the time will come when we'll see that this is, in fact, the case. And that's what Scottish media reported, and they did the due diligence, and sure enough, you know, that's the answer. But it affected the entire population that we were headed into, and it was effective. But once we were integrated into that population, you know, we're subjected to all kinds of things as well. But it was just this underlying signal that created that tension, and we saw how powerful that can be.
Well, if we had so much success in that particular part of the country, why can we not have success in Afghanistan? We're still losing people up there.
Yeah, I want to just comment on this quickly. I think, it's my opinion, that they didn't need to look for Osama, because Osama was killed dead in a doornail on December 13, 2001 in Tora Bora. You know, he wasn't alive. He's dead in a doornail. I mean, why look for a guy that's dead?
The thing is, I can't speculate on why the government or what their motivations are in using systems or not using them. All I can do is report on what we found and what we know. And what you're asking me to do is speculate on what I don't know and evidence that I've seen would allow me to go there. And this is what I won't do. I won't speculate. And if I do, I'll make it really clear that it's my opinion, because we report on the basis of the facts that we find, and we report those facts. And as a result of that, for 16 years, I've stayed credible in this work. I've done over 3,000 radio broadcasts, over 200 lectures, and dozens of documentaries with major film groups around the world on this issue as well as many other technology issues. And it's because we stick to the facts. The facts are enough. What we've seen with too many researchers in the alternative fields is when the facts no longer seem to generate sales for them, they start exaggerating those facts. And then before you know it, they're not facts anymore, they're fiction.
Right.
And what I have done is find a way to make my living while I'm pursuing the areas of interest to me, so I don't fall into that trap. And you know, and that is really important because I think we have a responsibility as reporters to be accurate, to shape the news in a way that people get the information so they can make decisions. I believe that's what the freedom of the press is about informing the public, not just saying whatever we want with no responsibility attached to it. I think we have total responsibility. What I say, if it affects you, if it makes you do something, I am responsible for that. And, exactly. And so when I get on the radio and I talk about these technologies, I take full responsibility for what I say, and I take it very, very seriously because I know people will act on what I say, and I encourage you, don't act on what I say till you verify it yourself.
Exactly.
And that's
always the best way
of real knowledge.
Now, speculate once and said that the U.S. would break their treaty, their missile treaty, within a year. And that was speculation, but it was also, you know, you got a lot of research to back that up.
Right.
You put a lot of time and effort into looking into things and saying, okay, here's where I think things are going to go. I think the U.S. are going to break that treaty within a year, and they ended up doing it in 3 months.
Right. It was with the European Parliament, and the committee challenged me on it because their intelligence community didn't deduce that. We did, and we said not only that it would be abandoned, but that the excuse to doing it would be there is no Soviet Union, therefore there is no treaty, which are almost the exact words of Senator Ted Stevens, who my brother replaced, when he rose on the floor of the Senate and made that statement, and we abandoned that ABM treaty, and it was that forecast of the future based on all the evidence that we had gathered that told us that convinced the European Parliament that we were a better source of information than the government interfaces they had in NATO and in the American mission, because we were at least telling them the truth.
There you go. You see, you know, you do enough research, you can figure these things out. And then you can, you know, you can say things and they eventually come to pass. You know,
even in that instance, I was very clear. Very, very clear that it was my opinion, but that time would prove it out, and it did. And you know, that's the thing about all of this is this story is not about me; it's about us and what's happening to us on this planet right now. And you know, NATO after that hearing, they went in there like gangbusters, and the American mission sent people into every office to try and attack me as a person. Which politicians know that game better than anybody, you know. If you don't want to deal with the facts, shoot the messenger. Well, I'm a reporter, okay? I don't consider myself a scientist. I am a reporter. You know, most of the reporters you see on the 6 o'clock news have no advanced degrees in anything. They're parrots for a press release. I do real research. I verify it with real scientists. And I put it in a book with real footnotes that you can go look up and draw your own conclusions. And in 16 years, any predictions we've made have been proven correct. And that is extremely important.
Okay. Just on an educated opinion, where do you think that the technology is today as far as mind control? And weather manipulation.
We're there. I mean, we have the capability. The big stuff that's going on now, there's a project in with DARPA and the University of California for modeling the human brain for electronic telepathy and then being able to impose thoughts on others. And that is actually moving forward. And I think that is a huge, huge concern and one that will, you know, continue to create problems. I think the mind control issue is the most important issue that I've ever covered. It's one that I'm going to continue to cover, you know, now and in the future. Perhaps at another time we can do a program just on that issue, and I think it'll be pretty effective. And I know we're right up against the clock at the moment. We agreed to be on with you guys for an hour tonight.
Yep.
But let's do try it again, and I really hope people check out our website at earthpulse.com, support our work by getting our books and publications, and then when you're done with them, donate them to a library so others can read them, or send them to your favorite politician that you might actually think might act on them. And that's how things get done, and it also keeps us in our work.
The other books that you have, Earth Rising. I believe we have two of them, Earth Rising 1 and 2. Are right. they available on your website, earthpulse.com?
Absolutely, and also all of, you know, Amazon, all of them have them, but that's the best, and definitely check it out.
Okay, are you going to be doing any? Go ahead.
I have one little question here. I saw on your website that you have some cordyceps information, and I have a bit of a background in mycology, so I was kind of curious about it.
Well, it's a hybridized cordyceps. It has 400% more polysaccharides than a natural. They're grown in labs in California, controlled environments. So they're not imported Chinese garbage. They're U.S. made to the highest standards in verified organic environment to California standards. So very, very high quality. And, you know, we consider it probably the best price for what we market. We have very good effect. We have a full spectrum, which has six different mushrooms and also has colostrum, which is or transfer factor from the organic cow's milk from the first six weeks of after birth. That combination is then reduced to by 95% particle reduction to get underneath the micron for absorbability. So, you know, those are things that we've developed in conjunction with our partners in here in the U.S. and in Germany. But our health supplements are pretty unique. We have four different ones. They're either based on a nanoparticle size or electron flows. And so both the things you've asked me about are relevant to improving overall health and capacity. Cordyceps are just incredible for a number of purposes, mainly increasing oxygen and stamina, among many other things.
Now, that's another whole area we could get into is...
I do a lot of radio. And in fact, some guys bring me on regularly because there's a lot that we are involved in. And again, we'll do this again sometime in the near term. Check us out at earthpulse.com. And again, thanks you guys for having me on tonight.
And I was happy to have you on, and we're going to close it right down right now. And thank you, Dr. Nick Begich, for being on the show. Everybody, why don't you go check out Nick's website at www.earthpulse.com. And you can check out, he's got all kinds. He's got HemiSync on there. He's got nutritional products, plus his books on harp, Angels Don't Play This Harp. And his latest two books. Now, do you have another book coming out, or do you have a speaking? Do you have any speaking tours you're going to be on that you want anybody to know about?
You know, I haven't. I quit lecturing 2 years ago, and I've considered starting again in the fall. And so, when those opportunities come, I'll start looking at them a little more closely. And then we post that on our website. We also have a flash list that we only send out maybe every few months. But if we're doing something like a lecture, we try and get that information out to folks.
Well, now everybody knows you're willing to do lectures again, so you'll probably get a bunch of calls.
Well, you never know how that goes. But I appreciate it again, guys, and let's do it again sometime in the future.
Okay. Good night, everybody, and we'll catch you guys next week.